another edition of Money Talk. I'm Neil Tricell, and Diane Duvernay, your host, every week right here at AM 1290, repeated at 11, and on Saturdays at 6. We're brought to you by Cornerstone Home Lending, whose highly trained and experienced team takes great pride in helping people with home financing, offering competitive rates and a wide array of loan programs. American Riviera Bank, smart banking for smart people in Santa Barbara, at Figueroa and Anacapa Streets, and in Montecito's Upper Village. And Arlington Financial Advisors, a leading wealth management firm in Santa Barbara, providing its clients with the personal care and attention of a small independent firm, coupled with the vast resources of a major financial institution.
Hi, Neil. Happy Monday.
Happy Monday to you. It's always a pleasant Monday when we can see each other.
Always.
So on this fine Monday, do we by any chance have a guest?
We do. We are thrilled to have Jasmine Bingham in studio with us. She is a vice president at Brown & Brown Insurance in town. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
So I like to sometimes say why we have an article in discussion today. And there are various reasons why I wanted to talk about this article, but this is the first time this has ever happened. We have two articles that back-to-back on the same paper. So this is page one and this is page two. So this is going to be very interesting because we end up saving paper because I only had to rip one page out. And they were both good articles.
That is perfect.
Yeah, so this is a first.
Very efficient.
Thank you. And hopefully very interesting. The humble title of this first article is called The 10 Principles of Financial Proficiency. And it begins by saying the true measure of financial success isn't how much money you make, it's how much you keep. And apparently Americans are pretty lousy at this. And there's been all kinds of talk about the fact that a recent study showed that two-thirds of earners would be hard-pressed to cover an unexpected $1,000 expense, a medical bill, a car repair, and more than 75% don't have enough to invest skillfully enough to meet modest long-term retirement goals. And the reason for this is, according to the author of this article, is financial literacy. And University of Chicago professor, Harold Pollack, said that it's really not that complicated, that he could put on index cards the things that you really need to know. You don't need to be a financial genius. You don't need to have huge amounts of paper to follow around. So here are his, 10 things that you need to know to be successful in investing. And the first is to set goals. Before doing anything, make sure you have a goal as to what you want to accomplish. Two, know what you've got and what you need. No matter what your age level is, always know how much money that you have today and how much you want to get at some future date.
I think that's an important one because there are so many people out there that don't even know how much they spend on a monthly basis. And really, until you know how much you spend, you won't know how much you need. And so without knowing, it makes everything a little more scary and, unable to actually set goals.
Yeah, one time I was, and I'm pretty financially, I think, literate, but one time I was trying to do a budget just to see. So I had different categories, and I had categories for my checkbook, and then I had one number called credit card expenses, which was 90% of all my expenses were credit card expenses as one number.
And you want to know what's funny is people often look at, and when you hear the word budget, it's almost like they feel like it's a bad word, something that they don't want to do. It's going to be miserable. What I always tell people when I'm talking about a budget is it doesn't have to be 100% right. It just has to be close enough. It's one of those things where you want to get the categories right. So if you just put credit card, that's not usually helpful to people in understanding how they spend. But it is helpful in the sense that you do know the number that you spend.
And the third is to save systematically, that is consistently save.
I always tell people when they start their 401k savings that just pick a number and make sure that it's enough, but not so much that you're always turning it on and turning it off. Because if you turn it on, forget about it, then you're much more likely to accumulate some wealth in your 401k or retirement plan, whichever
Well, you must have read this article, because the next one says invest in your retirement plan and take advantage of any freebies that your employer may be giving you.
Right. So many people don't put anything into their retirement plan, and then they're basically leaving 3% on the oftentimes 3-4%, depending upon the company. They're leaving it out. That's just free money. That's part of your compensation package. And a lot of people, when they look at what the number is when they're getting hired, they're only looking at what their compensation is that's going to show up in their paycheck. But oftentimes there are so many more benefits, like in the healthcare arena, you know, how much is the company actually paying for, if anything? That's part of compensation. How much are they matching in your 401k or equivalent? Those are really important numbers that can make a really big difference at the end of the day.
And the next one is one that's not so obvious, and that is invest for growth. If you're young and you're saving for retirement and your retirement's 30 or 40 years away, maybe a variable annuity isn't the greatest choice for you, where you're guaranteed a 6% return, when in fact what you should be looking for is the highest long-term growth rate you can get.
And I think the Great Recession that we just experienced, you know, I guess it's been a decade now, but has really affected psychologically the millennials. And oftentimes they're far more conservative in their investing than even their parents or grandparents. And the problem with that is they're not going to see that compounding growth that really, you know, having that doubling effect or having that money working for you is so very important. And if you're 27 right now, you do have 40 years to retirement. You should be investing in something more stock oriented. You shouldn't be in a bond portfolio.
And the next one is sort of like the catcher telling the pitcher to strike him out, avoid bad debt. But there is bad debt versus not so good.
I say that all the time when I look at the net worth statement of people. Yeah. I say assets from short term to long term, and debt, I say bad debt to good debt.
Right.
Because a mortgage is considered good debt. You're building credit. You're able to deduct interest up to a certain extent with the new tax legislation that passed last year. It is, whereas credit card debt is just simply that. You're paying interest to somebody, and you're getting no benefit.
You're paying a lot of interest to someone and getting no
yes.
benefit. And that leads to the next one, which is don't overpay for anything.
That's kind of a silly one, right?
Well,
because no one likes to overpay for
But the example he uses is like paying for a mutual fund that has a high fee.
Internal expense.
And when in fact there are alternatives to that. Next one is to protect yourself, and that is that there are going to be bad times, and make sure that, for example, you don't skip on insurance. You are able to have a period of no income by making sure you're not like the people we gave in the example that can't afford any bump in the road, and make sure that basically you're covered for unforeseen circumstances.
Right. The prudent philosophy on having an emergency reserve is you want to have 3 to 6 months worth of living expenses saved on hand in cash. It's not about getting a return. It's about paying for the unforeseen expenses if you were to lose your job or something major, catastrophic happened in your life. You could afford to weather that storm.
Next to last is keep it simple, and that is keep a diversified portfolio that matches market returns. Ignore hot tips. Don't check returns frequently. And keep your emotions and political opinions as far away from your investment decisions as possible.
That's great advice.
Yeah. And the last one is seek unbiased advice, and that is to make sure that your advice is coming from a certified financial planner who is designated not only based upon their education, but to act in your best interest as well. Now, I will turn the page. We spent a lot of time on that page, but let me turn the page. And this is teaching the teachers about fees. And this is an article about a teacher who decided that, and teachers have what's called a 403B plan. It's similar to a 401K plan, except 403B plans, for some reason, are not part of ERISA. That is, in a 401k plan, the employer has certain responsibilities to the employee. If you're issuing a 403B plan, you don't have the same ERISA requirements.
Well, 403Bs are usually attached to a public entity.
Right, and these are public school teachers, and this guy was so appalled about what he was saying, he became a financial planner. And his major effort was on stopping what he saw was
egregious fees within those?
Well, not only egregious fees, but basically everyone he knew was buying annuities because they were told they could guarantee them a 6% return. So 26-year-old teachers were given, as he said, a 400-page prospectus about variable annuities and said, this is really a good thing for you. And they were being forced into high exit fee penalties in order not to get a market return where they needed a good return over the next 30, 40 years. Instead, they were locking in what they thought was a safe 6% or whatever yield. And he said that was enough to make him realize that teachers needed teaching as well. And this goes right back to the first article about financial literacy. You're listening to Money Talk on AM 1290 KZSB, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to Money Talk, brought to you by Cornerstone Home Lending. Since 1988, a mortgage banker and direct lender that believes in providing in-depth loan consulting to its customers in a personalized and honest manner.
And we have in studio with us Jasmine Bingham, a graduate of Fordham University with a degree in economics and finance. And she's always had a flair for helping people navigate the financial markets. She was formerly at Goldman Sachs as a security analyst. And now she's settled in with Brown & Brown Insurance in Santa Barbara as vice president. And she specializes in providing employees with benefits and education to ease their troubles in buying sufficient insurance without breaking the bank, right? So thanks so much for being here with us.
Thank you for having me, Diane.
So tell us a little bit about group insurance, because as many people out there, they're employees and they don't really think much about it except when they get their enrollment packet and say, okay, I have choice A, B, and C. What is really, when you look at a company, what is the number one thing that you're looking for to solve the problem of employee benefits, or is it basically to retain employees?
Well, employee attraction and retention is a big deal because every company is competing for the best talent out there. And so one of the things that you want to do is, and what we do at Brown & Brown is we look at a benchmark for the company, the size of the company, the sector, the space that it's in, and we just take a look at the employee pool and benchmark across the country. The Mercer Report is a great one. And you get to see what other companies like yours are paying as far as contribution rates. It's averaging about 75% that a company will pay for an employee's health care plan. And that includes medical, dental, vision, oftentimes life, accidental death and dismemberment, short-term, long-term disability. And that's a nice package. And depending on the richness of your plan, whether it's, let's say, for the ACA plans, metal tiers, if you have a gold plan with a very low deductible, that's a nice, rich plan. And then if your employee contributes 75%, then you're only paying 25%. And when you look at the total compensation of something like that, what the equivalent would be, and we've done those numbers to try to gross up what the total compensation would be just from the benefits package, and this goes right to employee attraction and retention, oftentimes it's well over 10,000 that is that grossed up number that would be the equivalent of extra pay.
And so what I've heard recently is as people are entering the workforce, the younger an employee is, the less they seem to care about that. Is that what you've seen? Or,
Actually,
I feel like there's so much, you know, gross generalization about the millennials because they're the largest demographic group. You know, they're bigger than the boomers. I just always like to ask somebody like yourself, like, are you seeing that be a factor for them? Like, well, I don't want the health insurance.
Actually, what we're seeing is that the carriers and other groups that offer benefits are coming up with more creative creative packages or creative lines that go into an overall voluntary or employer-sponsored. And some of that lately now, it's tuition reimbursement, which everybody likes, especially millennials and the other generations coming up. And no, we shouldn't generalize, because a lot of millennials, if you want to categorize them, employees from 20 to 40, they love to have a nice benefits package, and they really appreciate the employee assistance programs, where it can help you find housing, it can help you find financing, it can help you with financial planning, it can help with different types of peripheral benefits like the tuition reimbursement, pet insurance. You know, a lot of little things, you know, that even legal services, and it can all be packaged into a bundle, depending on how you're shopping your plans and, you know, what your broker decides is best for your employee pool and the strategy of the plan mix and what they want. What I like to do is definitely communicate when I talk to a prospect, a company. I like to see if they've surveyed their employees. Do they know what the employees really feel is a priority for them?
Oh, and that's a great thing, because so many people start with this is what we need without ever surveying, you know, their constituents.
Part of that, I think, to give the employers credit, is that they're afraid of stepping on toes with HIPAA laws, the privacy and all that stuff, and they don't want to feel that they're being invasive or intrusive with their employees. But I suggest an anonymous portal, maybe, or a Dropbox, where you just write in. When you're getting a new broker, especially, who's going to do a nice plan strategy, go through a process of figuring out what's best for your employee pool and your budget as an employer, because both of those things have to combine and make that benefits value proposition the best it can be. So we want to know, is there a chronic condition within the employee pool? Is there a special RX? Is there a pharmacy need? Is there a diabetic issue? Is there something like, you know, respiratory issues, asthma, something where people have to constantly go in for some kind of healthcare management? And just make sure that that's included in the new plan design, if we're going to tweak it, if we're going to maybe add something or carve out, if it's depends on the size of the employer too, how much a broker can do. In California, if you're under 300, you know, we are not able to get all the tools that we can use Brown & Brown's other offices across the country. If you're 100 or even 50 in some states, you get claims history, and you can actually go and help negotiate and, you know, strategize different line items within the package of employee health care.
Right, and the 300-plus market is pretty small in Santa Barbara. So who is your target market, and who do you primarily work with locally?
As far as size of employer? Well, our focus, we are a publicly traded company. We're the sixth largest in the world, Brown & Brown. We're national. We have a lot of large national accounts, but we have different offices across, you know, all the continental states, I think now in Hawaii too. So the focus of each office is different depending on the market. In our Santa Barbara office, we focus on the small to medium-sized businesses, what we call SMBs. And my focus in particular is employee size of 20 to 250 on up. The 20 to 250 group is really great here. And what we like to do in our office in Santa Barbara is to extrapolate all that knowledge and expertise from some of our, you know, major subsidiaries. For example, Pacific Resources is the broker for Walmart. You can't get much bigger than that. But you take some of that experience and expertise and you bring it to the small and medium-sized groups here. And although we can't do everything we can do for a Walmart or, you know, a large global company, there are a lot of things and strategies and analysis tools that we can maybe bring that to the smaller market and at least point them to, you know, certain initiatives that they can take on, taking an offensive approach, like speaking to your employees and, you know, getting into their heads
education.
And know what preventative care you should have and what other ancillary things they might need.
So you must just be like the HR director's gold mine of
our
information.
My goal in particular, my team's goal, is to be an extension of an HR department, but also with the sensitivity of what the CFO wants.
Right. And I think that that's so important, as the laws have around health insurance have changed so much over the last 5 years or so.
And they still are.
And therefore, exactly that as the HR director, you can't possibly be an expert in that field, which is why I think using you is such a valuable tool for them.
And we also offer tools that keep up with compliance. We've added a tool called Zywave, which is basically an HR compliance library on top of other things, major content that's wonderful to share with our clients. Our clients can have access to Zywave for a free trial. If anybody listening would like to try it, get in touch with me and we can give you a 10-day trial period. And you can see the breadth of all the knowledge that's out there. So someone like a company like Zywave or, you know, another HR library will always have the updated language. And that's so important because if you are audited and the IRS is going back to 2015 now with a concerted effort to audit for ACA compliance, which is groups 50 on up. So you definitely don't want to be on their radar because it can be very expensive.
I live my life by trying to stay off the IRS's radar.
Don't we all?
Exactly. So
I kept off the radar for the whole segment, but I have to come right back on to say that you're listening to Money Talk on AM 1290 KZSB, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to Money Talk, brought to you by Arlington Financial Advisors, a leading wealth management firm founded on providing thoughtful, objective, and comprehensive financial guidance for families and entities who are seeking long-term financial confidence.
And we have in studio, if you're just joining us, Jasmine Bingham, the Vice President of Brown & Brown Insurance in Santa Barbara. So, Jasmine, let's take a step back and talk a little bit about your years at Goldman Sachs. So what did you learn there, and what interesting points can you share?
Oh, gosh. I was there for about 5 years. Worked down first at 85 Broad, their flagship, and now I think they've moved. But I was there for a while, and I learned, gosh, so much. I mean, to get a basket of stocks that you are the analyst for at a major brokerage firm means that you set the recommendations on buy, sell, hold, whatever it is. And you also have to speak very closely with the management there, the C-suite, to get get on their radar for all of the initiatives and how things are changing. And I basically built my own spreadsheets to mimic what their earnings models were. But you have to know all the components, and you tweak them all, and you get down to the bottom line earnings per share. And that's what the mean on the street is. You know, the Goldman number is one of maybe 10 others, which comprise the mean estimate. And if the company comes out with earnings and misses it or exceeds it, then you'll see the repercussions in the stock price that day. But back to what you asked, what did I learn? Communication skills are key. You learn how to communicate what you want to say to institutional investors. You have to learn very, very fast, pretty much on your feet as you're running to the morning call when earnings come out. You have to, or a transaction or a merger. I was waiting for my cable guy one day. I was moving apartments, and the one stock I had on the priority list actually announced a merger, that they were buying the number two company, and I'm sitting there waiting for the cable guy to show up. But I had to call in and talk to the CFO and get the scoop and be able to tell an investor, what does that mean for me transactionally? Should I hold? Should I short? And I've called many, many different things. I've called shorts, trading buys, and a lot of things like that.
Well, what did you follow? What industry?
Oh, good question. I followed the home builders. Mm-hmm. So I started with manufactured housing stocks. For example, Fleetwood, Oakwood, Champion, Clayton Homes, which is now owned by Berkshire Hathaway. I followed them, and I also followed the conventional home builders like K&B, Centex, Pulte. Yeah, Some of those have merged now, Ryland.
I was a securities analyst, too. I followed insurance stocks.
At
New York Plaza, right around the corner from 85 Broad.
I was at One New York Plaza. We moved there, the research department.
We could have a little coffee talk.
I was on 45.
I was on 32.
It's the ugliest building by South Ferry, isn't it? It's the one that has the first section and then the
what did Neil say
tower.
To me last week?
No, so I'll tell you.
You guys could have a coffee date, but let's not do this here.
I had no idea, Neil. What a small world. I was there. I left in 97.
We just missed. I left in 77.
Oh, we did just miss. So I started working when I was 12.
So
wow.
So what do you think?
Did you? We'll talk about this later.
Yeah, you can make a coffee date, you two. So how do you think those skills you were able to translate that sets you apart today at Brown & Brown and helping employers that you learned from being a securities analyst?
Well, of course, one of the biggest things that you have to have as a foundational element to even get into securities analysis is you have to have proven yourself as far as analytics. And analytics back then was basically parsing an earnings statement and looking at the balance sheet and understanding all the line items and how the different segments of an industry can push those line items up and down and how it affects the bottom line. So all those things you have to understand, and you have to be able to look at things and analyze them. Just like now in insurance, you have to look at the limits and you have to look at the coverage. You have to understand the company and the risks that are inherent in each sector. And there's a lot of risks that, you know, sometimes you don't know, for example, the mudslides, you know, for homeowners. So there's risk everywhere. You have to kind of see where that is in the periphery, but see where you are now and the current data that's available to you and be able to not only forecast it, but understand if the status quo were to stay the same and there's exogenous factors, how does that affect it? So the analytical part is what really the analytics and the communications and being able to think on your feet accurately, those three things really drive insurance success. And I love benefits because there's so much to analyze.
You also must really like reading a lot of fine print.
I have to. I've always had to. I was governed by the Compliance Council every time I went on the morning call or wrote a research report at Goldman. And in insurance, there's also compliance issues, and you have to make sure that you don't say something that is not true. There's errors and omissions risk in insurance. On Wall Street, you know, I was a Series 7 licensed registered rep. I took on that liability myself, so I had to be careful what I said. So, yes, that's a parallel.
Absolutely. And so now you brought up the mudslides. Do you find that people's thought about insurance, both benefits, including benefits, I guess I should say, has changed since that catastrophic event here in locally?
Anecdotally, I have heard that some people were very surprised that you do get what you pay for in insurance. If you want a very low premium, you're going to have to take on the risk. That's risk retention. And if you're looking at a multi-million-dollar home in Montecito and maybe for some reason you just want to be a penny pincher on your property insurance and maybe you don't have the coverage limits that a devastating mudslide is going to cause a rebuild and even a partial rebuild and you're not covered for certain types of replacement cost, you know, you do get what you pay for. Now, one of the things I do know that there have been carriers that have experienced a lot of losses, and a lot of carriers have exited certain zip codes. They have redlined, so to speak, certain areas. And we have a good relationship with a lot of other companies as well that are our competitors. And so when it comes down to the community, helping the community, some other insurance companies that could not help their existing homeowners that got non-renewed or they were facing a non-renewal did reach out to us, and we were able to get insurance because we have access to a lot of carriers. We're some, I don't want to talk about.
Smaller kind of captive insurance.
Exactly. They may not be able to have access to the carrier where we do. And so we were able to find, for everyone that came to us, we were able to find insurance. There was one that was exceedingly high, you know, and we also can help to arrange financing for the premium. But that was a big issue. I think most people are covered, but I do see the repercussions with some of the real estate realtors that I am friends with professionally. It has become an issue where now people come in and they not just think about what are my property taxes, what would my mortgage be. It's also what will my insurance cost,
or
and is
could
it
you
available?
Get insurance right?
Exactly.
Yeah, but what's amazing is the insurance companies, in all due respect, always seem to be at the wrong end of the cycle. In Montecito, the next fire will probably be 100 years from now because nothing's up there. And based upon a lot of the research, the next big flood will probably be 200 years from now. So now they don't want to insure. I mean, if there's any time to insure, it would be today.
I agree with you.
They're just so typical of bank insurance company groupthink that now they're getting out of the market.
Right. If anything, now would be the time to double down and insure everybody, capture the market.
Well,
these things happen. It seems like it's happening fast. They exit, and then it's very slow to come back. We'll just have to see what happens. But in the meantime, there are things that we can do. There is access for a homeowner who's struggling.
So Brown & Brown does do retail business as well?
Oh, yes, we do.
Yeah. You're listening to Money Talk on AM 1290 KZSB, and we'll be right back. By American Riviera Bank, making your life easier with cutting-edge technology, mobile deposits, free use of every ATM machine in the country, and a level of service other banks can only dream about.
So, Jasmine, as Santa Barbara has become more tech-heavy, you know, we've been dubbed kind of the baby Silicon Valley, if you will, how does a technology startup company go about working with a firm like yours? You said the sweet spot's between 20 and
250 on up. I mean, we can do so 1,000 or more.
Right. Pretty much. Like, what is the limit in terms of a technology company that's looking to provide some benefits to their employees, but maybe haven't scaled yet, so they're still at, you know, 6-10 people?
That's the perfect time to start talking to a long-term strategist, which is what Brown & Brown brings to the table. We don't do just an annual renewal. It's not a one-time conversation where we like to just come in and say you're up for renewal. We try to come up with a 2 to 5 year strategy because healthcare costs go up every year, because there's new products that are added, because your employee pool might change, because you might scale up. So there's all kinds of reasons to start the conversation when you are small. Some tech companies do like to go to a PEO, professional employee organization, and let them do all the work. There's a time and a place for that. But if you want to start building, we're talking about credit, building your credit history. If you are a company that is trying to build its own history, I recommend that you stick with a full-service broker and start adding up your credit history on healthcare and taking care of your employees, getting that benefits value proposition honed and ready as you scale up and do it in pieces, in waves.
Now, what would be the benefit to the technology company? Because I find, you know, with startups, everyone's really penny-pinching and, you know, they're bootstrapping it for the most part. What's the clear benefit of working with a full-service firm at that point?
A company that's under 125 employees, we have a service package, let's say. This is a great example. Not only will we help you know your initiative going out 2 to 5 years and be able to plan in stages accordingly, but we can bring you those tools, the HR compliance tools, the online enrollment, the paperless enrollment, the tracking online, the educational component that could be in what we call EB Tech, an employee benefit technology platform. And we use several. We are actually resellers as well. But we can give a gratis type of comped service for small groups so that they can have everything online, especially for a tech company.
Exactly. You want to be able online to have, is so huge.
You want to have educational tools. We're trying to figure out, we're in the middle of designing educational surveys and things like that where we can build it into a portal for a company so that we can personalize it and keep our hands on the pulse of what the population of employees is thinking, what their needs are, because they change. And we want to make sure that there's open communication so that they feel comfortable talking about what their concerns are, what their challenges are, what their successes are, and build a package of benefits that addresses that. And you want to have that in place so that a tech company can, it's not just about foosball and beer on Friday.
Right.
They are talking about that now. It's not about the foosball and the beer. It's what else can you give me? What are you giving me for the long term? 401k, benefits package, gross it up and let people know this is what I'm giving you in addition for working here And that's an attraction and retention tool, and especially for a tech company, because you're able to scale it up, but you're also able to get that benefits value proposition out there in the minds of your employees because they talk. There's a lot of tech meetups. I go to them. I'm going to one at the Goodland on Thursday. It's just a great community for tech, a lot of smart young people, and you want to make sure they know that they're taken care of if they work for you and be able to go to these meetups and talk about it.
And that's great that Brown & Brown has that, because the profile for the person that works for a company that has six people and it's a startup, through the life cycle of that company, also their employees change and their employee profile changes. You know, as they become more stable, people who, you know, the profile of the employee changes. And it's great to know that Brown & Brown has, you know, a suite of products that can also grow with those startup companies.
What do you see when there's a recession, or when a particular group of companies has an earnings problem? It used to be that this was one of the places that companies would look to cut. Is that not possible now because of the shortage of employees? But are companies less likely now than in the past to, you know, raise employee contribution to insurance or even cut back on benefits simply because they're looking for ways that they can save?
Yeah, that's a tricky issue because there is something called a consumer-driven health plan, which has a high deductible. Usually it's at least $1,350. More likely they're $2,000 to $7,000 on up. That's what the deductible is, but the premium's low. So there's always the chance to shift into a low-premium product, but a lot of companies don't want to do that to their employees. So there are ways that we can strategize a plan strategy to address the cost issue, make things affordable for different tiers of employees. There's the contribution level of the employer. You know, you can, as we were talking about benchmarking, you know, see where other companies are in your space as far as how much they're contributing to your employees' payout or their benefits cost per month on a group basis.
Do you find that many local employers actually pay for a percentage of their employees' health care, or do they pass most of that on to their employees?
Typically, as if you look at the benchmarking for small groups, you know, under 250, you're looking at about 75% paid for the employee only by the company. And then for the dependents, they could pay either 0 or 50%. It depends. They're not required to pay for the dependents. But I recommend 50% at least for the employee only. And there's in healthcare, there's different tiers. There's employee only, and that's one. And then there's employee plus spouse, employee plus child, employee plus family. You don't see all four tiers all the time broken down, but employee only is typically 75%. And it should be at least 50. That way you stay, if it's 50 or more employees, you stay above that critical threshold where you might get audited. So you just want to be able to contribute that much.
So what is the, what's the law? Is there some law that as an employer you have to pay some percentage of your employees' health care?
When you get to the certain sizes, there's, you know, 50 on up, you do have to offer it to everyone. And this is also a part of a very newsworthy thing. President Trump is just signing these new laws, mandates, and HRAs for individual coverage is a new thing that he just signed that should be implemented January 1st. What that does is if you've got salaried employees, they typically are making decent money. And those are the employees that are supposed to be offered group health care. And those are the ones that typically are going to get the 50%, 75% paid for by the employer. The hourly and the lower wage earners, which there are plenty of companies here that, you know, have hourly, part-time, we are now able to give them coverage because of what Trump just passed, this mandate. The individual coverage means that you can have two tiers. You can have salaried and you can have hourly that are, you know, not full-time. And now you can now go ahead and cover those people, offer benefits to them in a two-tiered system.
So meaning the employer doesn't have to pay the 50% or 75% they could offer
it's
it
to. It's just a new way to, you can have an HRA account, which is the cash pre-tax earnings account, that the employer could put some cash into that, and it's a higher deductible, so it's a lower premium. It's just a new strategy to now offer benefits to hourly workers and lower income workers. So the whole thing about healthcare being available to employees now has just been opened up by this whole new mandate of now offering it to the lower wage earners that are part-time and hourly. So,
and how does that compare to the Affordable Care Act?
Well, the Affordable Care Act, the individual coverage is the big thing here. You don't have to offer, if you're, you know, over 50, you do have to offer a comparable minimum bronze as far as to the metal tiers in ACA. But when you're a small employer, you don't have to do that. This new individual coverage HRA that mandate is now doing it for the individual market. That's huge.
You're listening to Ahara Presents. Excuse me, you're listening to Money Talk on AM 1290 KZSB, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to Money Talk, brought to you by Arlington Financial Advisors, a leading wealth management firm founded on providing thoughtful, objective, and comprehensive financial guidance for families and entities who are seeking long-term financial confidence.
So as we're in our last segment, Jasmine, what are some of the greatest benefits of working with you at Brown & Brown as opposed to any of your competitors?
Our tailored focus, we really look at what you have right now and look at the strategy going over the long term. We would like to plan out 5 years. We would like to discuss how to consumerize, treat your employees like consumers, because ultimately that's what they are. We want to educate the employee pool on the choices out there. You know, should I go to the ER? Should I go to urgent care? This is when you go to each one. Do you go to GoodRx? Do you price shop for your prescriptions? Do you understand what a copay is versus a coinsurance? And how can that benefit you when you're choosing which plan your employer is offering? We like to get into some of that educational component. I'm really big on communications, so my team tries to make sure the channels are open where we talk to the employer, my contact in HR, or if it's the CFO. We like to talk to them on a regular basis and make sure we're up to speed with what the initiatives are.
And if an employee has a question for the different plans, because I know it becomes overwhelming. You have all these choices and this and that and coinsurance, and, you know, it gets confusing for the individual employee. Are they able to contact somebody at Brown & Brown as well?
Yes. Just as Brown & Brown, the broker, is the employer's advocate with the carriers and underwriters, we also have a patient advocate. And you actually get a patient advocate card when you become our client. Upon enrollment, new enrollment, or renewal, one time you get that the patient advocate card. There's an 800 number. You call Carpinteria, our office, and we have a patient advocate that will help you with billing, provider search, questions about a diagnostic event coming up, how to plan for a surgery.
That is great, because that's so confusing.
You don't have to call the carrier and be on hold. We do that for you, and we also know who to speak to. We have our reps. We have our contacts. So it really helps. There are some stories. If you follow me on LinkedIn, we share stories here and there about patient advocates and how important they are.
Absolutely. And for those of us that are listening and would like to reach out to you, what's the best way to get in touch with you, Jasmine?
I can give an 800 number, and you can just ask for Jasmine. I'm the only Jasmine there, so that shouldn't be a problem.
But the beauty of having a unique name.
Exactly. 800-350-6328. That is Brown & Brown's office. And if you'd like to learn more about Brown & Brown, bbins.com is a good place to go.
And do you also have an email address?
You can contact me at jbingham@bbofcal.com.
What's the public name of the company? Is it Brown & Brown?
Brown & Brown Insurance.
So this is not a local. What was the local company before?
It was three agencies, and I don't recall all of them. This was well before my time. This was some years ago that have been here for many, many decades that Brown & Brown acquired to become this region.
So did you go right from Wall Street to insurance?
No. I actually came to California, got married, raised my daughter exclusively for about 12 years. When she went to college, I went into writing and publishing, did that for 5 years, funded that company myself, great learning experience. And then I wasn't sure what to do after that, and I read a book that got me into the exciting part of insurance. It just triggered me, and I thought, this is where I need to be.
Well, your daughter must be very smart. You said you raised your daughter for 12 years until she went off to college. So
I started working at 12 myself.
Yeah, so I mean, it's
12 is a good age for them.
Well, some people would like to send their kid off to college even younger.
Yeah, it's called overnight summer camp.
I know.
Well, you know, she saw me go to work as a working mom for quite a while, so it was nice to have the other side where I could be the mom and, you know, participate in all the activities.
Absolutely. And now you're a wealth of information and a real asset to our local community in our small business and thriving business community. So thank you for all you do.
Thank you so much.
It was really wonderful having you on the show. And thanks so much.
And thank you, Jasmine. And thank you for listening to Money Talk. And we'll see you next week.